It's not exactly too big to fail, but the troubles of a certain airplane company are causing some problems. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday today, the 21st of October. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Ticker symbol BA is where we begin the program today. The Boeing Company, a global aerospace manufacturer, as the company itself would surely like to remind you, but a company known best at the moment for the fatal problems with a single model of a single plane, the Boeing 737 MAX. Still grounded, still driving Boeing's share price lower, and the effects of which are still spilling out into Boeing suppliers and customers, and the economy as a whole. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman gets us going.
Let's start with the airlines. It's not like air travelers see a bunch of empty 737 MAX planes grounded on the tarmac, but Madhu Unnikrishnan at Airline Weekly says this is affecting the industry.
They've sold tickets against what they expected to have in their fleets, and now, for example, in American and Southwest's cases, they have 20-odd fewer aircraft, and that means fewer routes they can serve.
Meaning fewer options and higher ticket prices for flyers. Boeing is trying to get regulators to recertify the 737 MAX as safe to fly, so airlines will start taking delivery and ordering new planes again. The company hasn't stopped production, but it has slowed the assembly lines from more than 50 planes a month to just over 40, says analyst Scott Hamilton at the Lehman Company near Seattle.
If they further reduce production, then you're going to start seeing some layoffs. Labor force in administration, maybe in engineering, although they've got their hands full as it is.
How about the impact on U.S. growth overall? Paul Ashworth at Capital Economics says Boeing has slowed its purchases of raw materials and airplane parts, which is contributing to the slump in U.S. manufacturing.
Certainly what's been going on at Boeing has been a factor in all of this, as has the strike at General Motors.
But some analysts still think the company has a bright future. Here's Jim Corridor at CFRA Research.
If you're looking backwards, there's a lot of blame to assign to the company. If you're looking forward, Boeing is one of two companies in an industry that has seen very high demand. They will be generating profits for a long time.
He says when Boeing does start selling 737 MAX aircraft again, they'll be priced cheap to move. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Boeing's board, by the way, meeting as we speak in San Antonio, Texas, today. We have reported often on this program about the troubles besetting the retail sector. Falling revenues, closing stores, layoffs. But amidst all that, there is one big retailer opening an enormous new store in Manhattan, Nordstrom. The new women's store is going to be 320,000 square feet, seven stories high, lots of room for clothes and shoes, obviously. But it seems a big part of the business model is going to be about services. Marketplace's Marielle Segarra explains that one.
On the Nordstrom website, there's a page that advertises the new flagship store. And there are two lines on that page that stick out to me. No matter what you need, just ask. We're looking forward to serving you. There's a long list of services the flagship store will offer. You can get your leather jacket repaired, or you can get your pants hemmed in an hour. You can meet with a personal stylist or a beauty advisor for free.
They also have a number of high-end restaurants and eateries. They have the ability for customers to order food while they're shopping and even, I believe, drinks on certain floors with liquor licenses.
Cocktails served to you while you browse for shoes. Sonia Lipinski is a managing director at Alex Partners.
Nordstrom is providing a reason for the customer to walk in the door.
The theory, she says, is if Nordstrom can get people in the door, those people might stick around and buy some of the stuff that's hanging on the racks. Department stores have been struggling, but Sharmila Chatterjee, who teaches marketing at MIT Sloan, says there is still a place for them if they can give customers what they're looking for, which in many cases is an experience.
A place with the right kind of offerings and service and ambiance is something that customers will value.
One of the other services Nordstrom's offering, which might appeal more to locals, 24/7 pickup for online orders. Because people are doing a lot more shopping online these days. Might as well lean into that, too. I'm Marielle Segarra for Marketplace.
Boeing put the kibosh on what could have been a better day for the Dow. We will have the details when we do the numbers. Older workers, says the Bureau of Labor Statistics, are the fastest growing part of the American labor force, people 65 and older, which means we now have the most age-diverse workforce we have ever had. There are four, sometimes even five distinct generations working side by side in this economy. It works all right for the most part, but when you remember we've got more ways to communicate than ever before, sometimes you end up with complications. Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has that one.
Millennial Stuart Horgan doesn't buy into a lot of the tired stereotypes about generational difference. The operations manager at a tech startup in Boston has never taken a photo of his food and knows plenty of selfie-obsessed boomers. But when it comes to communicating with older colleagues, he sees a big divide on one small point.
They use periods a lot, which I didn't even realize this, but they sound very stern, like very final.
Or even worse,
they'll do this thing where they end their emails or their instant messages or texts with an ellipsis, so dot, 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 which for a millennial is just like the height of passive aggression.
He vividly remembers one instance on a Friday afternoon when he sent off a big presentation to a 56-year-old manager.
And he just responds, thanks, dot, 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 enjoy the weekend, dot, dot, dot. And that completely ruined my weekend. I definitely looked at the presentation for probably like 6 hours that weekend trying to figure out what was wrong with it.
Horgan is part of a generation that grew up replacing a lot of face-to-face time with text-based communication, so every last character is precious and pregnant with meaning. That's why he likes to use shorthand visual cues like GIFs or emojis to clarify his tone. But not everyone is on board, insert winky face.
Okay, now you look like you're 10. Like, oh my God, do we not have language anymore?
48-year-old Gen Xer Alex Malky likes to think of herself as hip with the young crowd. She's worked as a project manager in gaming and entertainment. But when it comes to the written word, she's old school.
It's like you can't even be bothered to write a sentence. Like, how does this reflect on how detail-oriented are you?
A recent survey from writing software Grammarly found workers under 35 were 50% more likely than older workers to be told their tone was too informal, even though more younger workers said they spent time agonizing over meaning, tone, and grammar in their emails. Miscommunication between different age groups is hardly a new phenomenon, says Bob McCann, a management communications professor at UCLA. But the fast pace of technological change is deepening the divide between generations.
Every 3 weeks, we have a new platform that we need to deal with or a new app that's coming out, and we have to adjust and we have to change.
He says communicating fluently over a broad range of channels, from conference calls to group chats, is becoming ever more important. And sometimes that should include emojis, says Vic Verma, CEO of workplace communication platform 8x8 and former smiley face hater.
Until it started dawn on me that if you send a bald text, the probability that it will be misunderstood is massive. And one little icon changes it.
It's all about context, he says, and tailoring communication, not to fit the learned preferences of one generation or another, but the demands of the task at hand. So email for deliberate, complex thinking, chat for shoot-from-the-hip collaboration, or phone for urgent matters. And sometimes there's really nothing better than some good old-fashioned FaceTime, like the real thing, not the app.
So the reason I wanted to talk to you today is about how you sign off most of your messages.
Remember Stuart Horgan and his ellipsis problem? I asked him if he'd be willing to meet with his boss, Tom Murphy, to get to the bottom of all those dots.
Did you know that in millennial culture, that signing off with an ellipsis is like the height of passive aggression?
I did not know that. I do now feel like I'm the stinky kid in class, and no one wants to tell me, and someone finally told me, so I guess that's good news.
Now, if someone could just explain the meaning of the 10 different smiley emojis, dot, dot, dot. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino from Marketplace.
It's never easy being a farmer, right? Uncertainty kind of goes with that job description, from weather to crop yields to market prices to nowadays trade wars and tariffs. So with harvest going full swing in a whole lot of the country, another installment now of our series, My Economy, about people out there just trying to get by.
My name is Blake Hurst, and I farm in Northwest Missouri. We grow corn and soybeans, and I also serve as president of Missouri Farm Bureau. We're about 2 weeks into our fall harvest, and it is without a doubt my favorite time of the year and the most beautiful time of the year as well. So I get the opportunity to do a lot of different tasks during the year because of the seasonality of farming. So it's just a different job every day, and I think that's what I like the best. I mean, we really have had a very wet year, and harvest is late. It's delayed. We're in a rush to get it done before we would normally, you know, expect snow and winter. And so there's just a lot of stress, and people are feeling that. And then they add that to, you know, just economic stress that we're feeling because of low prices. So, yeah, people are not happy. As it turns out, of course, the flooding and the excess moisture this summer has supported market prices by cutting production. But we can't sell as many soybeans. 2 years ago, we sold 1 in 3 bushels we raised. I mean, we, meaning U.S. agriculture, sold 1 in 3 bushels we raised to China. And those sales have essentially gone away. We're still selling some soybeans to China, but not nearly what we used to. And that's made the price lower than it would have been otherwise. So that's how it affects us. I mean, we're an agriculture community. I mean, our town has 1,500 people. Our county, which is about 5,000 people living here, so very low population. Almost all of them dependent on agriculture in some way. They work at the local seed dealership. They work at the grain elevator. They work at the ethanol plant. All those businesses have seen a drop in revenue, and so it's just an economic burden on everybody in the community. Am I going to do something different? I'm 62 years old and don't know anything better. So it's a little bit late. You know, farming, having said all those things, farming is cyclical. And as I tell my son-in-laws and nephews and stuff, when you put on that free seed corn cap, you know, like they give us, when you started farming and, you know, we're all excited about your first planting season, you knew that it was a business where some years are good and some aren't good, but you know that it will get better. You just ride it out and try not to be in a financial situation where the next down cycle will put you out of business. That's the key.
That was Blake Hurst. He's a corn and soybean farmer out in Atchison County, Missouri. We need you and your stories to make this series work, right? So take a second, let us know how your economy's doing, would you? You can do that at marketplace.org. Coming up.
And I want to pay so much more.
Not something you hear from your boss all that often. But first, sure, why not? Let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 57 points today, 0.2%, 26,827. The NASDAQ up 73 points, 0.9%, 8,162. The S&P 500 gained 20 points, 0.6%, 3,006 at the close there. The troubles at Boeing that Mitchell was telling us about have the plane maker shares in a tailspin. Analysts at Credit Suisse, UBS, and Bank of America, Merrill Lynch, all cut their outlook on Boeing shares. Closed down 3.7% today, did BA. Boeing's troubles, as Mitchell was talking about, starting to spread to some of its suppliers. Take Spirit AeroSystems, for instance, which builds the 737's fuselage. UBS downgraded its outlook for the company today. Shares down 4.8%. Meanwhile, Southwest Airlines, which has grounded more 737 MAXs than any other carrier, fell 0.4% today. Bonds fell. Yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.80%. When was the last time you saw it up there, right? You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. Heather Long, the economics correspondent for The Washington Post, had a story this weekend that resonated with us, the basic gist of which was that economists just aren't doing a good job telling economic stories, that maybe what the economic world needs is more English majors, a course of study that, as Heather pointed out in her piece, has seen a 25% drop in college majors since the Great Recession. Heather, it's good to have you back on the program.
Great to be back, Kai.
We should say here at the outset, you are, by training and background, an interested party in this idea of storytelling and economics, right?
Yeah, you've called me out. The disclaimer is I majored in both English and economics.
Okay, but more to the point, it's not just you who picked up on this phenomenon about English majors. Robert Shiller, no less a personage than a Nobel laureate in economics, also points out the importance of storytelling in economics. Tell me why it matters. Tell me why.
Yeah, it's really fascinating. I mean, one of these prominent economists, Bob Shiller, he just has a new book out. Narrative Economics is the title. And the whole point of his book is that stories matter. Basically, economists have spent so much of the last 50 years trying to build these super elaborate data models to predict human behavior. And at the end of the day, he says, actually, they should have been paying a lot more attention to what was in newspaper articles and what people were telling each other on internet forums or by word of mouth, such as, oh, get rich quick, you can buy this Bitcoin, or, hey, you don't barely have to put any money down to buy a house. You know, it's really interesting to hear one of the foremost economists in the profession basically saying that we need better storytellers and we need to be paying attention to stories.
But it's also interesting because, and you talk about this often in your writing, economists don't do themselves any favors. And the most recent example is the big Federal Reserve Conference out in Jackson Hole, where everybody and their dog gives a speech, but they're economists giving speeches and nobody is sitting on the edge of their chair figuring out what they're saying.
Yeah, that's right. Again, there were lots of papers that were very technical and trying to put new models. But the one person's talk that really got people stirred up was the head of the Australian Central Bank. Australia hasn't had a recession in more than 25 years, so people are paying attention a little bit more to what they're saying. And he got up, Philip Lowe got up and basically looked around the room and said, we need to be better storytellers. We need to be better communicators. And particularly at this moment in the economy, one of the best things you can do is tell people a plausible story. Why should they continue to invest? Why should they continue to spend? Why is this economy going to keep rocking?
One notes here that Jay Powell, the chair of the Federal Reserve, is advertising for a speechwriter.
The chairman of the Fed has come under some criticism in recent weeks that his communication has been unclear. And somebody reached out to me after this article went up over the weekend about the importance of English majors and sort of economists arguing for why we still need English majors to remind me that the Philadelphia Federal Reserve Bank has a whole team that's basically dedicated to improving communications for the Fed and translating econ speak into more palatable discussions.
One note of peril here, and this is in your piece as well, the idea that the president of the United States is forwarding his own narrative, is telling his own stories about the economy, even though they are not grounded in fact.
Yeah, that's right. Bob Shiller actually pointed this out to me. He said, you know, on one hand, President Trump seems to be trying to encourage this lifestyle of buying more and, you know, spending like a Trump, which may have some influence on the economy and on people's idea of what they should be buying. But a lot of his comments that this is the greatest economy in U.S. history are simply not true and not grounded in fact at all.
Heather Long, she's the economics correspondent, also an English major, by the way, at the Washington Post. Heather, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
The minimum wage, you know, right? Government mandated pay, $7.25 an hour federally, unchanged since 2009, by the way. A lot of states set their own. Related but different and usually higher is something called a living wage. In some parts of the country, if you do business with the local government, the law says that's what you've got to pay, a living wage. From WAMU in Washington, D.C., where the cost of living is pretty high, Sasha Ann Simons has more.
Anika Hobbs owns a small African-inspired fashion and beauty boutique called Nubian Human in Washington, D.C.
And are your designers local? Are they local?
No, so it's a mix.
She's not required to pay the city's living wage of $14.50 an hour because she's not a government contractor, but she pays it anyway.
I pay the living wage, and I want to pay so much more. I want people to work for Nubian Human and say, I can't leave them. They're just so awesome.
D.C.'s living wage dates back to 2006 and has been adjusted twice over the years for inflation. Most cities with living wages work the same way. In D.C., the wage is 50 cents higher than the $14 an hour minimum wage. Jason Anderson has worked at Hobbs' store for a year. He's 44, and today he's working a Saturday shift on what would normally be his day off. He says he needs the money, and he appreciates that his employer is paying a bit more. He says it sends a message.
Okay, well, I feel you're this valuable to the team, and I need you to be able to make it too, the same way that you are invested in my dream and want me to make it.
But as Washington gets more expensive, the father of two says $14.50 an hour isn't really enough to get by. So he works two other jobs.
What we accept as social norms is like working all of these hours and getting this wage and trying to piece money together, check to check, to try to provide. It's ridiculous.
Hobbs knows several of her employees feel this way. She says paying the living wage is a sacrifice for her.
I don't get paid. There'll be spurts of time when it's like, okay, we've got some good money in. You know, the holidays is a really great time, so I'll pay myself around that time. It depends on where the business is that I'll cut a check.
And when D.C.'s minimum wage rises to $15 an hour next summer, it will be greater than the living wage. Ed Lazier heads the D.C. Fiscal Policy Institute think tank.
The minimum wage is a floor. The living wage should be something that is much closer to what it really takes to live on.
In Washington, D.C., that would be just under $18 an hour for a single person and about $30 if they're raising a child. That's according to a nationwide living wage calculator created at MIT. The calculator looks at costs like rent, food, and transportation. Some advocates in Washington say it's time to raise the living wage again. Raj Agarwal is a co-founder of Think Local First DC. He says there are also other ways employers can think about compensating employees.
Are there other things that you're doing as a business, paying health insurance, providing for a 401k, that should be calculated into this concept?
Agarwal's group is trying to determine how many employers already pay the living wage and get more on board.
There are many businesses that we've already identified that are paying a living wage. And that their people don't know that they're doing it.
Anika Hobbs, the owner of the African boutique, doesn't offer health insurance, but she does give employees birthday gifts and discounts at the store. She would like to offer more.
If I'm not able to offer my staff benefits, then are you really employing people?
For her and other small business owners, there's another question. How much more can you pay employees and still survive in an increasingly expensive area? In Washington, D.C., I'm Sasha Ann Simons for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today about WeWork, the real estate company that wanted to be a tech company, which was, you might remember, once valued at $49 billion. That was privately, of course, because its initial public offering has, as you might also know, been 86th. Anyway, CNBC reports this afternoon the Japanese multinational SoftBank, which has already invested $10 billion into WeWork and loaned it another $5, is going to take control of the company at a valuation of $8 billion, give or take. Okay, we're done. Dow Industrial's up 57 today, 0.2%. The NASDAQ up 73, about 0.9% there. The S&P 500 picked up 20 points, 0.6% on that particular index. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, Daisy Palacios, and Daniel Shin. Eliza Mills is our special projects producer. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.